relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
Portions of the following program may contain pre-recorded material.
You're listening to America First with Dr. G.
And so I want to contrast the president's repeated statements about Nordstrom with the lack of comments about some other things, including, for example, the attack on Quebec's Quebec Mosque and other similar environments. Why is the president, when he chooses to...
Hold on. Before, because you just brought that up, I literally stand at this podium and opened a briefing a couple days ago about the president expressing his condolences. I literally opened the briefing about it. So for you to sit there and say, I know, so why are you asking why he didn't do it when I literally stood here and did it?
Statement.
I don't understand what you're asking.
Kellyanne's comment were about that the president doesn't have time to tweet about everything.
Right.
He's tweeting about this.
Right.
He's not tweeting about something else.
I came out here and actually spoke about it and said the president spoke.
The president's time.
What are you, you're equating me addressing the nation here in a tweet? That's the silliest thing I've ever heard.
Did he tweet too much or not enough? That's the question.
Oh,
we've got a guy who's going to answer it right here. Incredible. So excited. Have him one-on-one in studio. Former colleague of mine, served this nation in uniform, out of uniform. He's still doing it. Sean Spicer.
Well, thanks for inviting me to the layer. If you haven't been in this studio, and I know that the listeners see part of this if they watch it online, but this is impressive. You get a window into Dr. Sebastian Gorka.
You mean all the junk my wife is at home.
I think we, your wife and mine share that because I'm just jealous that you have more space. I get like a shelf.
Get those challenge coins out of the house, Gorka. That's the message I got from my boss, and I did it, and that's why all my fun stuff is here. Just a little modicum on the shelf behind me, but then the green room, it's full of it. We haven't done a video of that. John, we've got to do a little video of the green room.
I got a little tape.
Walking through the green room with Sean. Okay, good. All right, Sean, delighted to have you. We've got an uninterrupted, almost an hour to talk to you. First things first, for those, I don't know, who just landed from Beetlejuice, who don't know who Sean Spicer is, who've been hiding in a cave, Rip Van Winkle just woken up. For those who may not be familiar with your backstory, tell us, where did the Spicers hail from? How did you get into politics? How did you get into the Navy? How did you get into the White House? Just in 8 minutes.
Yeah, and then I got walked out. So I grew up in Rhode Island. My father was sold boats for a living.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What kind of boats?
Big, expensive ones. Sailboats.
So really nice
Racing
yachts.
Racing. Yeah. I mean, everything. They were basically, for the most part, 30-foot plus. Went from, cruising to luxurious, but not crazy expensive. I mean, nothing was bigger than a 40-footer. But they still weren't cheap from our perspective.
Is that Navy? Why Navy? Is that
thing? No, I think we grew up in Rhode Island. My father had been there two sides. My mother had been there two sides. You grow up in the ocean state, you better learn how to sail. And so that was his livelihood. He had grown up on the water. That was my sort of upbringing.
Politically, were they active, your parents?
Pardon?
Politically, did they?
Oh, no. No. They were active in, the PTA and in civic stuff. But honest to God, I know they voted. We always, but it was never a political discussion. Rhode Island tends to be a fairly Democratic state. We did elect Republicans, but it was never a political discussion. My father would always rail against the stupid jerks and, that changed this and passed that law. But it wasn't party specific. So the long and short of it is I went off to school to sail competitively. But one of my high school teachers had known that money had always been an issue for us. I mean, when you sell boats for a living, and I write about this in my first book, when you pass the luxury tax, which is what Congress and the president had done in the early 90s, And when you tax the rich, guess who pays the price?
The guys people, who work for the rich.
People like my dad who told me that poor people don't buy expensive boats. So we had some tough years. And one of my teachers who I had gotten close to as a mentor knew that it was trouble. I mean, we had some decent years, but we had some tough years. When people don't buy boats, you don't do that well. And so it was the late 80s, and he had said to me, when you go to college, here's my suggestion. Study Japanese language. Get a minor in economics, and you'll write your own ticket, and you'll never have to worry about money again.
Because what? Because this is like the 80s.
This is when Japan was on the ascent.
And so I
went off to Connecticut College at a very robust East Asian studies program. I enrolled in intensive Japanese language. I took it for
a
year.
The things I'm learning.
Yeah, there you go.
About Sean on my own show.
Yeah.
Japanese.
So
okay.
I woke up and I would do an hour and a half of class really early for college students anyway. It was like 8 to 9:30. And then you would have like an hour and a half, 2 hours in the language lab. The bottom line is I hated it. I literally hated it. It was.
What about it? College or the language thing or
everything.
What?
It was just not. I was doing it as a means to an end.
Right.
And so, but then I also was really bad at it. And so, my dean was very clear that, like, if you want to do the translation, a D in Japanese is a D in English. And you might want to find a new major. So I'd taken a government class. And I was like, well, wait a second. Like, I literally had this sort of intellectual awakening where I was like, I found myself not agreeing with the professor about the role of government and why you would do stuff. And so,
because the professor was a leftist?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Which is not no shock at most leftist, colleges and higher institutions. But I started to get involved. I volunteered on my first campaign in 1992.
Wow.
I volunteered in the Connecticut State Legislature as an intern. So I loved it. And so that's basically, how I got involved in politics. And I my first race, 1994, when Republicans won the House, we were one of the top races in Connecticut's 2nd District. We lost by 2 votes on election night, and after
what?
A 6-month recount, 21 in the books, which was – I still think that was ridiculous. But I thought we won the race. But we lost by 2. We were outspent magnificently. I think we spent a total of $200,000 up against a 14-year incumbent. It was insane. 52 towns in the district.
Right.
We literally were the definition of a grassroots campaign. I drove around listening to Newt Gingrich's Go Pack tapes, Rush Limbaugh. I mean, but it was a learning experience like no other. And I got bit by the campaign bug. And then I like to tell people I became like a minor league baseball player. I would go from campaign to campaign, wherever the next game was, and I could get paid a little bit more. My first campaign, I got paid $1,000 a month, take out taxes, add for gas. I mean, I was
literally. Was that a tough life?
It was, but like you're
was
around,
it, fun?
Like, it was fun. You're around like-minded people. You cared about the cause. You were invested in getting somebody elected because you believed in them and what they were fighting for. And so, you were all eating ramen noodles together. And I'm being serious. Like, we would scrounge wherever we could get free food or whatever because take $1,000 a month minus taxes, call it $700, pay for gas. I was able to stay in an extra room of a campaign supporter. But at the end of the day, it wasn't about the money. It was about, but then I just kept getting the next one, and the next one would be, $2,000 a month and then $2,500. So I managed my first campaign in 1996 in Western Pennsylvania. The guy ended up dropping out midway through the primary, but it sort of had given my career a kickstart, and the rest is history. I literally worked for, I think, 10 different members of Congress. In 2000, I was brought down to Florida to help Clay Shaw, who's a 20-year incumbent, who was down big time, headed into the final stretch, and we pulled that thing out. 386 vote win. Again, went to a recount.
That's
three
crazy.
Counties, Palm Beach, Miami-Dade, Broward counties, which if you think about 2000, we matched up. So we were going. But it was that exhilarating thrill of going out and taking an entity, in this case a candidate or a policy or whatever, and saying, okay, how do we win this? How do we win this marketing war, if you will? And anyway, so that's that. And then, c'est la vie. I joined the Navy, as you asked about, when I was 29 years old. I got commissioned very late.
You do that?
We had a family history. My great-grandfather was a Medal of Honor recipient. He had served in the Navy. You grew up in Rhode Island. You see it a lot. And I'd always wanted to serve. And I wanted something bigger than me. We didn't have fraternities at my college. But I always felt like in politics, you're fighting for your side, right? Which is great. You're involved in the process. but you're not serving the country in the same way. I think it is service because you're fighting for the values and the policies that the country will live under. So I think there is a degree of service in that. But I wanted a higher calling, and the thing about the Navy was there was something about knowing that, like, you were part of something bigger than yourself or a party. So I joined at 29 years old. I finished my 22nd year in the Navy last week, and I think I'm probably on the tail end of that career.
Well, we have something to discuss when it comes to
I think I know
certain board visiting visitors. Is that the
board
phrase?
Of visitors, yeah.
Board of visitors at Annapolis at the Naval Academy. We shall discuss. I'm still, by the way, White House. I'm still in my position as a presidential appointee on the National Security Education Board.
You better be careful.
Bring it, just bring it, Sleepy Creepy, because we're going to have as much fun, if not more, that Sean's having with you right now. This is One on One with Sean Spicer. Follow him at Sean Spicer, former presidential press spokesman, White House press secretary, host of Spicer and Co. on Newsmax, and most exciting of all, just in time for my birthday, he's got a new book. It's called Radical Nation. Not out yet, guys, but you can pre-order it, right?
Pre-order it now, and you'll get it the day it comes out in a week or so. If you pre-order it now, newsmax.com/23, or just go to Amazon, rather, and look either Sean Spicer or Radical Nation up.
All right. It's Radical Nation, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's dangerous plan for America. We'll be back with Sean after these messages. Relief Factor. Pain relief that works. Pain relief that's real. Pain relief that has liberated tens of thousands of Americans from their daily pain, me included. But it's not just me. It's people like Leah from Ohio. This is Leah's story. One Sunday morning, I sat on my couch in so much pain I was in tears. That's the day I ordered Relief Factor. Following directions, in 8 days, I found relief. Only to get better and better. I am a believer 100%. That's her story. It should be your story. Find out today. Order the 3-week quick starter pack at relieffactor.com. It'll be at your door in 3 days or less. Take it morning and evening just like I do. And I promise you, Dr. G's guarantee, by the end of those 3 weeks, you will know whether it works for you like it works for me. What have you got to lose? Well, accept the pain. Do it today. It costs just $19.95. That translates to less than a dollar a day. What can you get for less than a dollar a day? Can't even get a cup of coffee, but you may get liberated from your pain. Call 800-500-8384. That number, 800-500-8384. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com.
This is America First, and here's your host, Dr. Sebastian Gorka.
Welcome back to One on One with my good friend, Sean Spicer. So, let's finish the story. How you got this fascinating career transitioning from Asia studies, Japanese, into politics, running campaigns. How do you end up in the White House working for the 45th president?
I was mobilized in the Navy from 2008 to 2011. I got off active duty in basically January 2011. I went on terminal leave, and so I was looking for the next professional move. My wife and I wanted to start a family. We didn't really think politics anymore was the right, the most stable and conducive to raise kids. And so I was looking for some corporate stuff, and a mentor of mine said, there's this new chairman of the RNC, Ryan Spreebus. He had just been elected. You guys should talk. We met. We hit it off. My wife was like, look, this is probably what you want. Going to the national party is sort of like the major leagues. And she understood how important that was and said, okay, it's a 2-year gig, go for it. Well, we finished the first 2 years and we really wanted to change the party and make some huge changes in how we did business, meaning we wanted to shift away from all ads, get more into a data-specific model where we helped candidates up and down the ballot, reform the primary system, reform the debate processing system. So we stuck around for 2 more years. That made it 4. We did very well in the midterms. And then, not sticking around for a presidential is sort of like walking out before the Super Bowl. And so, again, I said, look, my wife is literally like, oh, my God, it's now going to 5-6 years. So we did it. And, I led the debate process in 2016 and got to know all the candidates.
What does that mean, led the debate process?
In the past, up until 2016, both parties had no say in their debate process. None. So if you saw a debate between Republican candidates or Democratic candidates, they had nothing. In 2012, when Reince and I were at the RNC, when we went to a debate, we had to ask ABC News, CNN, could we please have two tickets, sir? We'd like to attend the debate. And they'd be like, for your party's debate, we had nothing. And I said, this is wrong.
Yeah.
The idea that
how did it get to that point?
It had never changed because news media organizations would then announce a debate and then everyone would go. And I started saying to myself, why are these left-wing hosts dictating our schedule and the questions? So we made some reforms. One, we limited the schedule. Two, we made them geographically because candidates, the two most important things for a candidate are their time and their money. And so if they knew where the schedule was, okay, the first one's in New Hampshire at this date, and the second one is they can plan accordingly. They're not wasting – because what was happening in 2012 – ABC had announced a debate on like a Friday – no, a Saturday night in New Hampshire, and then NBC had it on a Sunday in New Hampshire. And so they were like, you know, I'm going, what are you debating?
Right.
So I thought that this made sense for the party. I led that effort. I am a firm believer that the party is like a league. You don't choose among your teams. You just want a good season. You want the best team to emerge as the champion. So not everyone agreed with me on that. But because of that, I got to know all the candidates and their teams. And – Trump became the front runner. I dealt a lot more with him and his campaign about, you know, his issues with the debate, the format.
Why? Because he was more media savvy?
Yeah, but because he had never also done it before. So he'd be, okay, why am I here? Okay. How do we figure this out? Why can't I do that? And so we would, some of it was, and then some of it were demands. I'm going to do this. You better figure that out. So I got to know him and his team. And then when he won the Indiana primary, We had faced off, as I think every candidate does, where you kind of sit down with the nominee. The difference is Trump didn't have this big, robust, bureaucratic, to some extent, campaign apparatus. It was him, a Twitter account, and a handful of loyal people. So when we first met and we were kind of trading what we had, I was like, okay, I have like 75 people that work for me in D.C. and another 200 in the field, and their comps team was like four people.
Yeah.
And it was because he drove it.
Yeah.
And so we synced up in a way that had never happened. I always tell people if Mitt Romney had won in 2012, I would have been like the deputy undersecretary for communications at HUD, which I'm sure is a very good job. I'm sure I'm not, but that's what happens. You, the RNC or the DNC are the JV teams. Like you get the jersey,
right?
You get to go to the pizza party, but you're not starting.
So did you connect through that process? Did you personally connect with the man? Is that why?
And so when he became the nominee, it was actually a call in August. So Steve Bannon and Kellyanne called me one night. They're both on the phone, and they said, hey, tomorrow it's going to be announced that we're taking over, and we need you. Come up.
Taking over the campaign.
Yep. Yeah. And so we negotiated a deal where I would spend most of my time in New York working with the campaign. And
what was your official position then?
No, I mean, I still was the chief strategist for the party.
Oh, okay.
But what we did is...
But he was now the candidate, and so you...
He was the candidate, so yeah. I basically moved up to New York and worked out of Trump Tower. And so, look, on December 22nd, he had won, obviously, on November. And then he calls me on December 22nd and says, okay, let's do this. You know, put out the release. And I was like, that was it. And I think, to be honest and straight with people, I'd love to say that we had like 1,000 people in the resume process and he was interviewing people. But I think there was a very limited number of people that had earned his trust, that had experience and wanted the job. And so, you know, that was it. And then... C'est la vie. It all went from there.
We'll talk about what happened inside the building. The book is Radical Nation. It follows Leading America and The Briefing, but the new book is Radical Nation. Sean, tell us, give us your take on what happened in 2016. Our former colleague, friend of mine, Mike Flynn, called it a peaceful revolution. I find it amusing as an immigrant that, you know, I like to remind my fellow Americans, it's the first time in the Republic's history that we elected as president a man who wasn't a politician and wasn't a retired general. From Washington to Obama, every single president was a senator, congressman, governor, or retired general like Eisenhower and Washington. Something big happened in 2016. What does 2016 represent to you politically? Not you know, right. Individuals, right. But you know, right. In framework.
No, I think it's the first time that the American people felt like they had their voice heard in a way that it hadn't. What Trump got, and still gets to today, frankly, is an understanding of what people feel government isn't doing for them, and how these policies affect them. And you know, Seb, the one thing that was fascinating that I always tell people is that for 3 years of the last 3 years of the Bush administration, I was the assistant U.S. trade rep for the Bush administration for public affairs, meaning I was just the spokesperson. And forever, we would hear why we couldn't do things. We couldn't renegotiate NAFTA because, well, it was signed and sealed and we couldn't do this. And I get it. But that was the mentality. Yes. And frankly, that's the mentality that permeates government. And I get it. And so I was always like, okay, I get it. This is stupid, but we do have a signed deal. And you got a guy like Trump that comes in and you tell him it. Well, you know, there's this signed deal. And he says, so what?
And it was one of the most refreshing things about
it. And it was just the thing that was so weird is if you think about it, why aren't more – because – I don't think you should tear up everything for the sake of it.
No, but just ask the questions.
Right, ask the questions. Why do we just keep doing things the way that we always have? Why don't we challenge the system? Can it do better? Can we do better for the American people? Can we be more efficient and a better steward of their tax dollars? Can we deliver a better product? Do we still need to do what we're doing anymore? Yeah. Right? I mean, think about this. Trump's view was you haven't modernized an agreement. When NAFTA was signed, there was no internet. So we're dealing with problems that didn't exist then that, frankly, when you signed the deal, you couldn't have even thought of. So why not modernize it? On behalf of America, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And at the end of the day, it all worked out. And if you are in the car industry, you're getting a better deal now as an American worker in that industry. If you're a dairy farmer, you're getting a better deal. If you work in the technology field, your IP is more protected. But it was a way of thinking that had never come in before, because previously you would have had some guy that would have been like, okay, here's 18 PowerPoints and, you know, this is the process. And Trump was like, no, that's not – if it's not working, screw it.
I didn't come up with this phrase, but I love it. Somebody said there are no sacred cows for President Trump.
No.
And if you come into the room and he says, so why are we doing it this way? And you dare to say, well, because that's how we've been doing it for 20 years, you were in big trouble. The book is Radical Nation. We're going to discuss it momentarily, but stay here for more One-on-One with Sean Spicer. Gun Owners of America is the only no-compromise gun lobby. From battling the Biden administration's radical anti-gun agenda to restoring your constitutionally protected rights in the states, GOA's grassroots army, led by a friend of this show, Eric Pratt, is ready. GOA has a proud 45-year history of defending your Second Amendment rights without compromise. GOA's mission is simple: to protect, defend, and restore the Second Amendment. For just $25 a year, you can take an active role in the protection of your rights. When you join today by visiting gunowners.org/GORKA, you will receive a free gift. So help protect the Second Amendment by joining Gun Owners of America right now at gunowners.org/GORKA.
Dr. G is in the house on America First.
And we're back. With Press Secretary Extraordinaire, Sean Spicer. Sean, tell us about your time in the White House. What kind of a ride that was for you. We played this clip at the beginning, this insanity. Why didn't you mention this? You mean the thing I talked about 2 days ago at length from this point? But he didn't tweet about it. I mean, just the sheer insanity. Talk to us about what that was like to live through. And then give us your take on what went wrong in the Trump administration. What went right, what went wrong?
So, I mean, look, it was tumultuous. It was intense. I think look, this goes back to what we were just talking about. Trump upset the apple cart. And every president, both parties that come in, need three groups, right? You need the press, you need donors, and you need sort of the permanent K Street lobbyist types. Trump's view was, if you want to join me, great, but I don't need you. Yeah. And what happened was...
because he won without them.
Yes. And they were... But here's the thing. I'll say it in a very PG way, but like they're used to having their butt kissed. And they're used to people saying, I'd love to have you come over to my house in Georgetown for a dinner party where we can just the ins and outs of the NATO. You know, it's like they want you to, you know, and he was like, look, I'm doing this. I'm doing it this way.
If you want to join me,
join me. If you want to join me, great. But I don't need you. And it pissed them off.
Yeah. This especially the conservatives know who thought that they were, you know, the Bill Kristols of the world. So, what do you mean you're not coming to me for a briefing
right.
as a candidate?
How do you do this?
How dare you?
I'm fusion.
Right.
I come
Kiss
with the
ring.
Kiss I'm, the I ring. Come with the drapes. Right. You know, and I think that was upset, and especially for the press corps. And that was their thing, is that they were like, you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to act this way. You're supposed to. And again, my sort of marching orders from Trump were get my message out, do what I want.
So, to be honest, and I'm not sure I'm the good measure of this, because if I'd had your job, I would have been a flamethrower in there. I would have derided them all. Any lessons learned for you from the podium?
Oh, God, yeah.
Would you have done it the same way?
No. I mean, there's...
What would you have done differently?
I would just back this up for a second. I live my life every day, personally and professionally, reflecting on what I've done. Did I do... I mean, there could be an interaction with you where I go, gosh, why didn't I say hello, you know, earlier today, that guy that I just walked by?
Yeah, because, I noted it. It was noted.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we'll get the note. But I think that that's how you become a better person, professionally and personally.
Reflection.
Your reflection. Right. So I look back and I saw a clip like that and I go, okay, they were trying to get my ire up. They were trying to get my Irish going. And there are days when I was like, you know what I should have done? Just laughed at them. Like, you know what we talked about. So there's a couple moments like that. There's some things that I wish I had said or done differently, of course. But generally speaking, I think it was fun to be part of a historic moment in time where we did break norms. We did do things differently. We didn't have to abide by the tradition of everything. And Trump allowed us to break glass. And I mean, some days I broke glass and, you know, it shattered everywhere and he'd hold us accountable. People ask me all the time, you know, he is a tough guy to work for. But he holds you accountable. And like, you know, and to your point earlier, you better not come at him with like, well, because we used to do it. But it's intense. It's tumultuous. But it's also exciting and rewarding.
Okay. And what went wrong? What is the biggest take home for the 4 years? And how much of the loss last year was really down to COVID and 80 million mail-out ballots?
So I think what went wrong in the White House, simply put, is... Trump was a newcomer to politics, right? You think about, you mentioned all these people, governors and military leaders, whatever. They come with a trove of supporters, yeah. Loyalists, whatever, and you know, lobbyists or whatever, donors. Trump didn't have that. So he comes in and he's like, you know, pulling a guy like me and then Gary Cohn for National Economic Advisor, Steve Mnuchin for Secretary of Treasury, Dan Scavino had been with him to run social media. I mean, okay, all talented individuals. Right. But, you know, it's like a baseball team. You all get thrown on the field. You've never played together. You're kind of like, okay, who's got what position? And so there's some growing pains, number one. Number two, there's some people that should have never been there. Three, there's some disloyal people that should have never been there.
And who are actively disloyal.
Yes. And so I think that when you're walking into an environment like that and your focus should be forward and yet you've got to constantly be checking your six, you're going, that makes it difficult. I think that one of the biggest lessons learned for Trump is if he ran again and won, that I think he would start with a better team that he knew got his agenda, understood what was at stake. Too many people in that administration didn't understand that it was Trump's agenda, not theirs. And they
just didn't care about the agenda.
Right. Sure. Fair enough.
Utterly.
Yeah.
Couldn't care less.
So that was the thing, is there were too many times where during my tenure, I'd pick up the phone and be like, guys, What don't you get?
Yeah.
He said X, give him X. Don't do like H and J. And that right. Too often they'd be like, well, what we're going to sell him on is like, no. He's 74. He's been in business. I mean, like, he knows what he wants.
Yeah.
He's not here to be sold.
And you're not going to change him. I remember, I mean, you were the press guy, but I remember being asked numerous times, you know, on camera. So what would you say to the president about this tweet or that tweet? And I'm not going to tell him anything. After 14 years of the most successful reality TV show, you're not telling a 74-year-old how to communicate differently. Sean can maybe do that differently, but he's not going to. That was my response always. This is America First on the Salem Radio Network, coming to you live from the ReliefFactor.com studios. I've done something I can guarantee no one else in my audience has done. I've sat across the table with the man who formulated the process behind Balance of Nature, Dr. Douglas Howard, doctor, professor, scientist, one of the most brilliant health experts you'll ever meet, and I know him. When he described to me his 20-year journey that resulted in one of those powerful supplements on the market today, I knew I had to start taking it. You will probably never have the privilege of meeting Dr. Howard as I have, but you can make the same decision I did to get those 10 daily servings from 31 different fruits and vegetables, all derived from Dr. Howard's process. Believe me when I say Balance of Nature is the real deal. For a limited time, all new preferred customers receive a 35% additional discount and free shipping on your first order. Use discount code Gorka. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com, promo code Gorka. That's 800-246-8751, balanceofnature.com, code Gorka.
on the side of the U.S. Constitution, America First.
And we're back with Sean Spicer. Now, we've been trying to plan this for weeks, if not months. We've got you in studio fabulously for the release of your book imminently. You can pre-order it right now. Everybody needs to read it. Radical Nation, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris's Dangerous Plan for America. Everybody has to read it, but give them a little bit of snippet as to why you wrote it.
Right. So there's two things that are important to understand: the people and the policies. If you read this book, I learned a lot writing it. I didn't realize.
You always do.
No, but I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. This is what Kamala Harris really did.
This is what they believe.
There's one chapter in there called Biden Inc., which is about his family, his brothers. I mean, I thought the grifting just went to like a one brother and Hunter. No. It extends well beyond that. But when you look at the people and the policies, you will get it. Yeah. Right. You understand what they're doing. Joe Biden said the other day, last Friday at a press conference, if we pass my 1.2 trillion and my 3.5, we will fundamentally change the structure and nature of the economy. That's what's at stake. I write about this in the book. The reason they support D.C. statehood, immigration policies that allow people to flow over our border, and the way that they want to pack the court is because they are in pursuit of the most progressive policies and most progressive presidency ever.
Yeah.
And you need to know that. And the one thing that the book gives you is ammo to fight back. When you understand what the argument they're making is and how to deconstruct it, and whether it's Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, Columbus Day, when you have that crazy uncle or aunt that's going at you and talking about tweets and this and that, you will be able to say, really? Because here's what's at stake in the country. Here's who's leading our government. Here's who the policies are they're pursuing and why they're bad for America.
So his predecessor as boss, as President Obama, used that phrase before the inauguration, we are about to fundamentally transform America. He really didn't. I mean, even Obamacare didn't make that much of a huge political change to America. But your argument is
unequivocally. There's, I mean, you can't argue with what they're doing. Now, here's the problem. If you make D.C. a state, you add two Democratic senators. Yeah. If you pack the court, if you add millions of new voters over our southern border, and make no mistake about it, that is
that's
their plan.
The objective.
I don't. It's staring at us. You can't undo it. You brought up Obama, Obamacare. How long has it been? 8, 9, 10 years now. We can't undo it. Yeah. Once in the federal government, always in the federal government. When they do this, they are trying to institutionalize progressivism forever, and it cannot be undone. If we don't stop it now, it will never be able to be undone. I hate to be that doom and gloom, but part of the point of the book is to say you need to understand what's at stake. There's a chapter in there, chapter 20, the last one in there. It's a call to arms. And it says, look, if you want to be informed, if you want to join organizations, if you're a parent that is concerned about your kids' education, the wokeness, the critical race theory, here are the organizations, here are the means, here are the groups that can protect you, help you, inform you.
Okay, so to that end, if these are the stakes, if this is the last attempt to not only fundamentally change America, but to lock it in so that nobody can change it with whatever it is, lowering the voting age, getting rid of the Electoral College, the Supreme Court being packed and so forth, I have to ask you, you know, something that we've discussed privately, that you said you're going to make an announcement about this year. When are we... as patriots, as people who call themselves conservatives, you don't have to say I'm a member of the GOP or Republican, but when is our side going to stop playing by their rules and wanting, as you said, the invitation to the dinner
problem.
Party in Georgetown?
But that's it. So here's the problem. And I get it. Like, I figure, like, I'm almost a recovering person in this. because I get it. You come to D.C.
And you want to be fit. You want to fit in.
You want to fit in. Right. I get it. And I've been there, right? Right? And you think somehow, if I just do a little bit more, they'll like me and they'll accept me. Okay?
And they never do.
I want to go to the dinners. I want to do this. And you realize fundamentally they will tolerate you, but they will never accept you.
Well, okay. They'll tolerate you as long as you have utility.
Correct. As long as you have utility. And sometimes they maintain the utility because maybe we'll need you in a year or two. Right. So it's not like they're going to fully dismiss you. But at the end of the day, these folks do not like me. They probably don't like you, but I don't want to say that.
That is a statement of fact.
But they want to go to their dinner parties and talk about, you know, how they can – because they want to play in between a set of guard rules. And it's like, okay, well, if we elect a Republican, you can only go this far to the right, and we'll say, and then we'll all still go to each other's parties and talk about how great we are.
But there's no guardrails anymore for them.
No.
So on the left, you know, we, you know, the establishment wants to be inside the guardrails, but the left doesn't. So when are we going to get serious?
Well, we're going to get serious when we start holding these guys accountable. Right? Here's the deal. At the end of the day, why is any Republican going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner? Why?
Right.
Why? Because you want to sit down and rub elbows with, I get it, Bradley Cooper's really handsome and he's in a movie and you hope that you get a picture with him. I get it. That's going to look awesome on Instagram.
But he still thinks you're nuts.
Right. He doesn't like you. Yeah. Okay. And I get it. It's really cool to have that picture. You'll probably get a couple likes on Instagram. But at the end of the day, we can either keep, like, we're complicit in this. We, as a party and as a movement, in some ways, not everybody, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of guys that I think say, screw it. I don't care.
Not enough.
But here's the thing. We don't hold them accountable. And I think that that's what we need to do is start saying, great, you want to go do that? That's great. It's a free country. I think we have a right. We shouldn't do what they do. Like, if you want to go do it. But then don't say that you're on the team anymore. Yeah. Right? Because you can't keep playing with them. And I'm tired of all of these people that weasel out and go think, if I just go hang out on The View, if I go do all these things, they'll like me. And I'll be okay. They won't like you. And all you're doing is giving them credibility. Right. Because every time you show up on Chris Cuomo's show right now, you are undermining the fact that this is a guy who, A, kept his brother in office, and, B, has serious allegations against himself. So when Republicans go on them and give him credibility, yeah, they're hurting the cause.
So what do we do? What is it going to take? Because there's only one Donald Trump.
Right.
Doesn't there have to be a group rejection?
There does. And I think that we start – it's like a name and shame. I think people have got to be willing to understand that there's consequences. And again, I don't – some people might say, great, I don't – that's who I am, and that's fine. But I think that if we don't start all agreeing that there are – that we're going to form an alliance, that we're not going to do certain things, that there is a home on the other side, why don't we have our own little dinners? And, like, there's no reason – I, for some reason, we get guilted into this. Like, the press has a right to the First Amendment. They can have as many dinners as they want. I don't really care. But we also have a right of freedom of speech and a freedom of assembly. So why are we going to justify them? Why do we sit there in the audience, allow them to clap while they make fun of Donald Trump, right, us, and the right?
Sarah Huckabee Sanders insulting right her, and then we... So you heard it here for the first time live. We're breaking news. The new White House dinner will be at Sean's house this Saturday. I'll bring the dessert. Be there. No, seriously, we got to start something. This is America First. Please tell me you're not calling our show on a cell phone that's tied to one of the big cell phone carriers. If you're with one of the big guys, guess what happens? At the end of the month, you pay your bill, and then they make massive donations to evil organizations like Planned Parenthood, to gun control organizations, to social media that wants to censor you. Why would you fund your enemies? Go with the only Christian conservative cell phone company, Patriot Mobile. They have plans to fit every budget, extra discounts for first responders and for veterans, and they're on your side. They've proven it. They have donated tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars to the causes you believe in, the sanctity of life, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and they have the same nationwide cell phone coverage with the same towers as the big guys. But they're on your side. Call them today, 972-PATRIOT. You can keep your old phone number. The switch is super easy. That's 972-728-7468. Or just go to patriotmobile.com/GORKA. patriotmobile.com/GORKA.
The most awesome pipes in talk radio, Sebastian Gorka.
Welcome back to One on One with my buddy, colleague, Sean Spicer. This is the big question I want to ask you, Sean. Where do you stand on the future? And not about President Trump or right, the Trump phenomena, but the concept of America First, which every party should agree on, that America's interest should be first. The interests of Americans in America should be first. Where does that movement stand today? Are you optimistic? And can it survive with people who may be great tacticians behind the scenes in the Senate, but who at the end of the day maybe into the power a little bit more than they should be?
So first, America First shouldn't even be controversial.
Yes.
This is, if you are running for office and you're not thinking, the number one goal is to make America stronger, better, and more prosperous, then you're in the wrong business, right? So that shouldn't be – that. Like, frankly, the sad thing is that we have to ask.
Yeah.
Secondly, and that's what I think was so great about Trump, is that he showed us that if you're willing to do it, then you can be successful. So – and then I think the second part of your question is we need to hold people accountable on the policy piece.
Who's the we? We hold
them
accountable.
Well, the we is me, which is I have a show every night at 6. I'm going to ask the questions. I know you sure as hell do. But I think we've got to start telling our guys that at some point, winning for the sake of winning – I'm a party guy. I love the party. I want more people with R's on their name. But doing it for the sake of doing it, I'm conflicted sometimes because right now you see one vote made the difference in the Senate, right? I am literally praying every night for Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin because if that falls through,
yeah.
I don't know what happens to this country. That's the point of the book. We literally will have a radicalized progressive nation that we can't come back from. So on that hand, we need to protect bad things from happening. On the other hand, like you're saying, we need to start implementing policies like I was talking about in trade. We need to have a mentality that says, why not put America first? Why not? I mean, why are our veterans not getting the best care? Why are we not? Why are we skimping on certain things? Why are we saying that companies? I mean, look, I think we all know what works, but for a lot of reasons, we don't do the right thing. For example, the Republican conference yesterday cut the Chamber of Commerce out. Okay, we're going to talk about it, you know, on Spicer and Company for the next few days. But the reality is that the Republicans are slowly getting that we are not the party of big corporations. We are the party
not
of
anymore.
Little workers.
Not anymore.
We are the party of the working man and women that are out there saying, hey, I just want to play by the rules. I want to take care of my family. I want you to make sure you don't get in my way. Right. But we have been so focused on making sure big companies, and I get it. I'm not anti-corporation. I love corporate. I'm a capitalist. But at the end of the day,
it can't be to America's detriment.
Right. And you've got to make sure that you're protecting the working men and women.
All right, guys. Get it now. Radical Nation by Sean Spicer. The other books are The Briefing and Leading America. Follow him at Sean Spicer. Watch him every night on Newsmax at 6 p.m. Follow him. I just have one thing more to say. Thank you for your service in uniform.
Oh.
Thank you at the podium. Thank you at Newsmax and wherever you are. God bless you all for listening. We need more Sean Spicers. Keep your head in a swivel. Watch your six. Hold the line. Never give up. Never give in. And stay frosty.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.